After much debate, the Illinois General Assembly has approved a pension reform bill, one that Governor Quinn says he'll sign. The bill was opposed by most East Central Illinois lawmakers, and public employee unions plan to challenge it in court. But if pension reform survives a legal challenge, what will its impact be? How will pension benefits change in the future for state employees and retirees? And will pension reform really help Illinois government dig out of its financial hole? I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we look at pension reform with Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio and Rick Winkle of the U of I Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. They did it. It took years. But yesterday, the Illinois General Assembly passed a pension reform bill. The vote, 62-53 with one voting present in the Illinois House, and 30-24 with three voting present in the Illinois Senate. Governor Pat Quinn supports the bill, but here in East Central Illinois, most lawmakers voted against it, with the exception of Bloomington Senator and GOP gubernatorial hopeful Bill Brady. The three other Republicans running for governor oppose the bill, as do some conservative groups who say it doesn't go far enough, and public employee unions that say it goes too far. Those unions plan to challenge the measure in court, and that could mean a wait before we find out if this pension reform bill actually becomes operating law. But in the meantime, we're going to try to figure out exactly what lawmakers passed yesterday and what it might mean for you, whether you're a state employee or a pensioner or just a taxpayer. Not just a taxpayer, I guess not quite the way to say it. Helping me out this hour is Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky out in Springfield, where she has been immersed in this measure and the politics surrounding it for the past few days. Amanda, welcome back to Focus.
Thanks so much for having me again.
And also joining us on the program is Rick Winkle of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Rick directs the Institute's Office of Public Leadership. He's a former lawmaker who served as a Republican member of both the Illinois House and Senate from 1995 to 2007. You could say that Rick Winkle wrote the book on Illinois politics. At least he co-wrote it, namely Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide. He wrote it along with Jim Nolan and the late Samuel Gove. Rick, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. Good morning.
And I guess the first question, we've seen pension problems looming for years. Maybe I could ask this for you, Rick. Why has this problem continued even after attempts to fix them in the past? Why has this latest fix been so difficult to pass?
Well, the interests that line up on both sides of the issue are very powerful, and it's a very serious, deep-seated, long-festering problem that we've had in the state of Illinois. We thought in 1994 that we had had it solved during the Edgar years, where we were embarked on a 45-year track of reducing the debt in the pensions. It had a large ramp up, and it didn't quite survive the great recession that we had and the fiscal mismanagement, especially during the second term of the Blagojevich administration, which has now put us in the soup that we find ourselves. So it's a very difficult one. You just described, you know, who's happy with it and who's unhappy with it. Both very powerful on both sides. Both have good points and issues, and there's special interests involved, like the University of Illinois Higher Education, that are specifically impacted in special ways that make it very difficult in the detail trying to work out a compromise, which this bill is a compromise through a conference committee, which hasn't been used in decades, by the way, but appears to have worked, at whether you like this outcome or not, to come up with a compromise formula. But it's been very, very difficult. People believe very deeply in this. And really, you know, at the end of the day, you're talking about, yes, taxpayers, and you're talking about retirees. You're talking about people's lives and their savings and their retirement plans. And it really hits home. People feel very, very strongly about this.
Amanda, from, what you heard from lawmakers just in the midst of the final voting, how are they feeling about this, and what finally brought them together to vote on something and approve it?
Well, I think what finally brought them together, we first of all have to look at timing. And, of course, there is an election on the horizon, so that put legislators in a particularly difficult point. That said, they all knew what sort of primary challenges they're facing, and that's oftentimes in Illinois where we see contests. You don't have all that many competitive districts. That gets to the whole effort toward redistricting reform, and if we want to get into why that is, another day. But nonetheless, that came a day after the filing deadline. Right. So that issue was off the table. There also, I think one might even say that Senate President John Cullerton had made some comments that got him into some trouble, saying where he didn't think Illinois had a pension crisis. If you actually listen to what he said, there was a whole lot more nuance there. Nonetheless, of course, that word, that line got picked up. I think that he therefore had to maybe back off some of his stance. He had a different position when it came to how he thought Illinois could go about a constitutional fix than did the other leaders. And so he had to pivot off that point somewhat, and I think didn't want to be seen, you know, as the one standing in the way. There were some changes at the top. House Republican leader Tom Cross had stepped down. He is still a member of the House and interestingly did not vote for this pension issue, although he's long been calling for an overhaul. And that may have perhaps come into play just in terms of different personalities at work. So I think there are all of those things, and really most importantly that for whatever reasons it may be, you that you had the leaders all come together. And in Illinois, of course, legislative leaders anywhere are powerful, but in Illinois, that is very much the case, more so than in other places. And so when you had all four of those individuals, and then Governor Pat Quinn, who had been saying and making a lot of hay about, I want pension reform, I want pension reform, I want pension reform, but not saying what he wanted, that he came out and said that he would sign this and kind of stopped it with any obfuscating on that point, helped legislators to give them some cover, knowing that if they took that tough vote, he wouldn't be, you know, whacking them over the head and using the bully pulpit to say, hey, this isn't good enough, this isn't what I wanted, they didn't do the right thing. So that all, I think, came into play.
Well, as we continue our discussion on the pension bill and pension reform, your questions are welcome. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Besides phone or email, you can send them to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Amanda, I know, you know, a year ago, or at least a few months ago, we had two different pension bills. We had the House pension bill, which I understand would have cut more money, and we had the Senate pension bill, which I believe Senate President Cullerton argued was more likely to get through court. The version that came out of that, is it a little of both, or does it lean more in one direction?
Well, that's for sure a criticism from some of the people that voted against the plan that they are saying, and that's a criticism that you're hearing from unions. They think that it is far more closely matched to the Madigan version. That's the one that got through the House and actually was called for a vote in the Senate but did not pass there. So the one that clearly was not the bill that Cullerton had really been long backing, that he had negotiated and had the blessings of the major state employees' retirement unions and teachers' unions. So that may be the case in terms of how it deals with the COLA. Cullerton's idea had been something called consideration, that basically you need, because this is a contract, if you're going to break it, you need to have something in exchange. Nobody would, you know, willy-nilly just say, hey, we're going to call this off. The employees would need to get something in return for what they were giving up to bring the state savings. There may be an element of this, at least, again, the proponents of it say that they aimed to do so in addressing those constitutional questions, in that state employees, teachers, university workers, such as, frankly, me and you, will not have to put in extra 1% of our paychecks toward pensions. So that's kind of what the consideration is supposed to be considered. There are some changes, however, from the Senate Bill 1 Madigan version, and that's what the Speaker himself, who really gave himself a lot of pats on his back. He was clearly taking ownership of this, but nonetheless, also giving credit to some of the Republican leaders, he said, for sticking to their guns, and for John Cullerton for helping to put this over the edge. So taking a lot of credit, but also spreading the credit and or blame. He said that some of the last-minute negotiations also put this over the top, and that helped to really find a compromise. So, for example, You had this conference committee working all summer, and the plan that they had put forward would have given these done away with the 3% annual compounded cost of living increases and instead tied it to a half of the consumer price index. And so what Madigan said, he said, you know, hey, we want to do something that will make this more palatable to those who are concerned about the effect everything has on state employees who are giving up their benefit reductions. Let's make it a little bit less and instead tie it to a whole consumer price index. So there's a formula. It's not just whatever the consumer price index does the go up. That formula takes into equation years of service with the state, and there's a multiplier there. But broadly, that would, you know, kind of help that out. And then he said, by the savings that we get from that, we will go around and put some of those savings back into the pension systems by helping to pay down that $100 billion liability that has built up over the years that Illinois was not paying its share.
Okay. Well, Rick, let's, if I can ask you a little bit about the COLA, the changes in the cost of living allowance. What do you think that does for people who are on pensions, and what do you think it does in terms of saving money?
Well, that's where all the savings comes from, primarily. That's the reduction. And by the way, I think it was Senator Redonio that came up with the idea for mm-hmm. adjusting the COLAs. And so it is a big change. I mean, the interesting part of it is the speaker then yesterday in his presentation could say with a straight face that he was, yes, they were going to get the full consumer price index. But what he, you know, the devil's in the details, of course. It's an actual major reduction because the formula that you just described is it's the years of service times $1,000 or in some cases $800 and then times the CPI or 3%, whichever is less. And that's going to severely cut back on the amount of the increase. So if you have if you've been in for 30 years, you have a $30,000 pension. So you take 1,000 times 3, 30 rather, you get 30,000 times the 3%, you get $900 increase. So for that person, that's a lower income state employee. It's not going to make that big of a difference. But if you up the pension in amount to, say, 45 or 50 or 60,000, that's where you start to see the impact. You still get the same $900 increase, but obviously you would have gotten, you know, up to two times or more of that in the future. So, you know, it could be a 50% reduction in your cost of living adjustment depending on your income. So the higher the income the state employee, the bigger the whack that you get from this COLA adjustment. And that's the U of I's problem, higher education's problem, is that, you know, when you've got high income state employees such as, you know, law professors, business professors, engineering professors, medical professors, high-level administrators who really don't have a voice at this table and don't have the political clout that others might have, they're the ones that are really – the meat axe is really going to them. And they're looking at anywhere from 50 to 65%. I've heard Professor Jeffrey Brown make that calculation, subject to further revision here as we learn more about this, but huge decreases. So, you know, as far as, for instance, University of Illinois, I can certainly understand President Bob Easter's opposition to this bill, that it's really going to have, as you look here to Central Illinois, to the University of Illinois, it's going to have a profound impact on our ability to retain and attract the research scientists, engineers that we need to run the university and keep it a tier one research university. So it's going to have a major impact.
You had the legislative leaders really try as a selling point this COLA plan in that it would, they say, you know, protect longest serving but also lowest paid employees. That was supposed to be a good thing. Hey, look, we're not going to do something that dismantles the pensions of those who really need it and
right.
Who depend on that, who are lower income. And yet, as you said, of course, there's so much nuance there. When you look at state employees, I mean, this affects teachers. This affects, again, state workers. So you would have prison guards. You could have a neuroscientist that's working at a university hospital, for example. I mean, the breadth of type of state employee that this affects is so wide. And you're right, they're not, the legislators aren't paying really any sort of heed to that. That's where really it gets into the politics. So whereas right. you had, for example, university lobbyists trying to work against its passage, when you had so much else working at the pension situation, just the kind of the ball had been getting bigger and bigger, rolling down the hill, and finally there it goes, bam, it hits. That was not going to be the scalpel wasn't there. We could, of course, see follow-up, but I think that's even proven difficult when you have something that gets, you know, this much media attention. And again, looking, we cannot forget that there is an election ahead, that anything that has pension related to it can often be twisted and turned in some of that campaign literature. And so the legislators that say, hey, no, we need to cut benefits, which is whenever you say cut Illinois' pension costs, basically that's what you're doing, is cutting benefits. And they would be wary of doing anything that would be seen as doing other than that, doing the opposite. And so that's where I think the university, for example, is in a difficult position when you have a different sort of recruiting than one would have for a more typical state worker. That's just that nuance isn't there.
And I should note that the university has said now that it is considering a possible supplement to the pension. Exactly how much that will be and how it will be paid for is a question, but it is something that university officials have said that they're looking at, and the faculty groups have also said they would like to see.
Right, and the thing is, before everybody becomes very alarmed, I mean, this is serious stuff. It affects people's lives, but be sure to, if you're a university employee, be sure to get advice from SERS. You know, go get advice, find out for you specifically how it impacts you. Don't make any jump to conclusions and make any life-changing decisions at this very moment. There's much that needs, the ramifications need to be studied. The university is talking about, yes, perhaps creating a supplemental program. Will it be in place by the time this bill goes into effect, which is July 1, 2014? That remains to be seen. We don't know yet. So there's a lot of things in flux. There's a lot of work to do. Yesterday did not end everything. But, Jim, kind of getting back to it, just kind of a thumbnail sketch. If you're making $45,000 or less, this is as a state employee, this is probably not going to be a negative impact on you. This is, in fact, it may actually work to a positive because the 1% reduction in your contribution. If you're from $45,000 to $110,000, as you go up that scale, it's going to have a greater effect, more negative effect. Mm-hmm. As you reach the new salary cap, which is really the key to the MEDACs here, there's a cap to the pensionable salary at approximately $110,000. People already making more than that are grandfathered in, or if they make more than that or will make more than that from a collective bargaining agreement, they're grandfathered in. But for those who are, let's say, young people that are on an upward trajectory and perhaps will make a large salary in the future in the system, they need to be aware of that. And those are the ones that we would lose to the outside because we can't retain them, because if they're going to take, you know, we just reduced their retirement benefit, future earnings, post-employment by anywhere from 50 to 65%, we're not going to be able to retain them without a supplemental program. So you need to find out how it's going to specifically affect you. Don't make any plans yet, but just kind of watch this and see how what the university does, what SERS does in response to the ramifications here.
Rick, I'm wondering, we're talking in the context really of the last several years of relatively low inflation. And if we were go to a period of high inflation again,
such as
the country had in the late 1970s,
right.
The reduction in these COLAs could look a lot different, especially to the people on the lower end of the pay scale.
Right. In the 1970s, you saw a time where there was 6% inflation, at times up to 10%. Even if we kept the 3% compounded, that really wouldn't be much protection. In low inflation times like we have recently, it seems like a windfall. But when you have high inflation, it erodes your benefits. It erodes your retirement fund. And, yes, you end up not being able to afford your retirement at some point. You know, with this reduction, that exacerbates the problem and will further erode people's ability to live in retirement.
And I'm also wondering about another feature in the in the pension reform bill. Amanda, if you can talk a little bit about this, workers will now have the option of moving to a 401k style defined contribution plan voluntarily as an alternative to the pension plan.
So that's something that members of the state university's retirement system have had the option, but not for the teachers or the state employees' retirement system. This does add that, but the problem would be that you can't have too many people flooding over to that because then there wouldn't be enough individuals paying into the pension systems. Not saying that they would. Nonetheless, there is a cap of 5%. Cap, kind of first come, first serve of people that would be able to move into that plan so that you don't have the entire pension systems falling under. That is something that some of the conservative legislators are at least, again, we can talk perhaps later about maybe the politics of this. So Republican gubernatorial candidate Bruce Rauner, who really made a, tried to make at least a big power play here, he says he wants everybody to move over to this 401k style plan. So instead of a defined benefit where all of these calculations and formulas, you know what eventually, obviously depending on, you know, stock market returns and such, but what you're going to have, leaving it to the employee to take with them, as we've seen so much in the private sector. So that will be an option. And I think it could be not the last that we'll hear of it. Then again, this is very much obviously a Democratic state, which is remarkable, I think, when you have others look at it and when you talk about why this couldn't happen for so long, that's because obviously unions have fought it and unions and Democrats are traditionally allied, and that you saw so many Democrats kind of break ranks with their traditional friends is very telling. Democrats want to kind of keep control. You'll have government wanting to keep control of these packages. And so I'm not sure, but that is something that I don't think we've heard at least the end of yet.
The defined contribution plans or self-management plans, SERS, yes, you're correct. There was that option in the past. And for those who chose that in the past, the changes that occurred that will occur once this is signed into law will not affect those plans. It's only the defined benefit plans that are affected. The defined contribution plans are not. And the 5% option, you know, if you can switch over to a 401k type plan, will not be identical to the one that was offered in the past. It'll be yet a new 401k type plan that is provided for in this new legislation.
Okay. And a clarification, if you're not a state university employee yourself, you might not know that SERS is the state university retirement system, one of the pension plans that the pension reform bill affects. Let's take a call on line three. David in Urbana, you're on Focus.
Thank you. May I comment on the 401 type pension plan and a defined benefit plan? Really, saving with the 401 is very good in building wealth, but it's not particularly good as a pension for retirement because you can only take about 4 or 5% out of what has been saved per year because you have to allow for inflation. And you have to figure not that you will have to save for the average lifespan, but for the greatest lifespan you might have, say 100 years, instead of what is the average life now, around 83. Therefore, you can only take a much more limited amount from those savings per year. With the defined pension, you're working rather differently in that you're working with average lifespans. And the program can be built to withdraw from the total savings so that the average person will have expended all of their savings at an average lifespan. But because some will pass away prior to that, and some will live much longer, the fund balances out. And actually, the payout per year can be much higher. Would you care to comment on that?
Rick?
Well, I think that sounds pretty accurate to me, and it just reminds me, I want to be clear as I describe these. I mean, I'm not advocating going one way or the other. If this is available, you might consider it, but I think you should, for all the reasons that were just stated. You want to talk to a CSRS advisor or your own financial advisor to make sure this is the best route for you individually.
Why do conservatives, such as, for instance, the Illinois Policy Institute and the gubernatorial candidate, Bruce Rauner, why do they like 401k as really the way to go?
Well, it meshes with a conservative principle that we don't have faith so much in being taken care of by government, let's say, but maybe the conservatives would say instead that we should take care of our own financial planning and management, and they like as much control over that and being able to invest within the marketplace to the extent that they can with these type plans. And so that's what I think is the attraction, is that it's less government, more individual responsibility.
Well, and then one of the, I think, the issues that people have given with moving solely to this 401k style plan, and, you know, you kind of hear a lot of talk with this when you look at the literature from, for example, Bruce Rauner and one of his uber-rich friends and donors, Ken Griffin, the wealthiest man in America, and an op-ed that he wrote in the Chicago Tribune comparing what Illinois should do and kind of tying that to Social Security. I think it's worth pointing out that in many cases, teachers, for example, state employees, don't get Social Security. So
right. There's
critics have some fear toward moving solely to something that is dependent on the markets when you don't have any cushion for a lot of these individuals. The pension is supposed to is supposed to be enough to cover what somebody would get from Social Security and then, of course, hopefully plus. So it's not an apples to oranges comparison when people try to often tie a pension benefit toward somebody that is getting something from the private sector. Often their jobs, obviously, are their company is paying into typically Social Security, and you have, for example, school districts not doing so.
I want to thank David for the call. And go on to another caller now before we go to the break. Danny in Urbana on line two. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. Several very quick points. One is the state legislators can't resist cynically feathering their own nest. So in Section 2126D, they have granted themselves the right. They're not allowed by statute to have a pay increase between elections. So if they get a committee appointment or something, it would boost their salary. They can't receive that till the next election. But they are allowing themselves in this legislation to count that salary, which they did not receive, towards their pension benefits. The second point is that the general number that's been bandied about in the press is $100 billion pension shortfall. The Democrats, or the leaders, are claiming this will save $160 billion. The fraud here is that only 10% of these savings are actually going to be used to shore up the pension system. 90% is going to be used simply in general revenue for them to spend in a variety of other ways. If they were really sincere that this is a pension fix, 100% of the savings would go to shore up the pensions. I'm 61 years old, 20 years into paying in for benefits that I'd been promised when I began employment. For them to now say for the next 4 years they're going to reduce my contribution by 1%, but in exchange for that I'm going to have deep cuts into my pension, is a fraud.
Okay. Well, Danny, thank you very much for the call. And I'm wondering, you know, one of the points that Danny made, which was about where the money goes and that only 10% goes back into the pension funds, was a point that was made by some Senate Republicans yesterday. In this area, both Dale Ryder and Chase Berrickman made that same point. They thought that was not fair. But Amanda, did you see that? Any other further debate? Any answer to that complaint on the supporter side?
No, as you said, I think that's something that we heard from Dale Ryder. I think was he had a kind of great line about it, and he just said, you know, what is wrong with us? It's like there's some sort of genetic defect that legislators have that makes us unable to put those savings. We just want more money to be able to spend, and that will be built into it. And, you know, so he made that argument. didn't necessarily get any quality retorts. I think instead what you're hearing from the people who are who back this plan, that they say, hey, look, no, look at what we're doing. We're doing multiple ways. That's one method. They're also putting some debt service once it's complete, we'll go back into paying down the unfunded pension liability. So they are saying it's a selling point. We're putting more government money in. They're not really all that worried and not wanting to put the focus on that other 90%.
Rick, what are you seeing as far as the politics of why the money is being doled out that way?
Well, you know, first of all, let's back up a little bit. There's going to be the basic required payments that the actuarial studies come up with. And so what this, as I understand this legislation, and
it's
I'm
over
not the,
an above. Yeah.
Right. I'm not an apologist here. I just looking, trying to figure out what exactly it does say. So those are in place. And they also give a funding guarantee in this bill that which is something they didn't have before, where the five employee pensions can sue directly to the Supreme Court if the legislature fails to make those payments.
Which could be pitting the pension funds against the legislature,
right,
essentially.
Right, I understand. But that's something new. That's something that they did add. But in addition to that, there's supplemental, you know, add-on contributions, $364 million in fiscal year 19 and $1 billion annually thereafter until 2045, until the system reaches 100%. Then we get to the point that you're talking about, the 10%. You know, we could talk about why it's that way. I think they had to do that in order to pass the bill. Or, I mean, on the one hand, you have, let's say, the Senate Democrats. I'll pick on them. Maybe they want to expand some programs, and so they want to take that 90% savings, and maybe they want to, you know, do that instead of putting it back into the pensions, only put 10%. So as a part of the quid pro quo or the trade-off or the bargaining here, as part of the compromise, that's where they came up with that. On the other hand, Dale Ryder and in the conservative point of view, looking at this and saying, well, wait a minute, if we're serious about this, let's put, you know, the bulk of that, the lion's share of that savings back into it, which is what the caller was calling about too. I understand that. But in order to reach this compromise, that was the trade-off. That's where we ended up. But you end up with, you know, a funding guarantee. You end up with supplemental contributions, at least 10% of the savings going back into it. And those are pure add-on. Now, the problem with all this, Jim, is real simple. Why are we in this mess in the first place? Because we lack the political will to manage fiscally the way we need to in this state. We often are so undisciplined, we can't stay the course. Well, we chart a course. We charted one in 1994. It didn't work. So this is the same apparatus, the same organization talking about a new course. Do they have the political will and the discipline to stay on track here? That's, to me, the greatest question.
Okay, let's take a short break now, and we'll continue our talk about the pension reform bill that was passed by the legislature yesterday with Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio and Rick Winkle of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We are dissecting the pension reform bill, which the General Assembly passed in Springfield yesterday. And helping me hold the scalpel is Rick Winkle of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs and Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. Amanda, where do you find the time to sleep during...
Haven't much lately.
Well, they'll do their best to answer your questions about pension reform. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580, and the phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. I don't know if we have the answer to the question from Rick from Champaign on line one, but let's at least get it out there so maybe somebody else might know. Rick, you're on the air on Focus.
Hello?
Rick.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for your talk today. I have a very brief question. For people who have purchased service credit for prior years of service to the state, how might this legislation affect them?
Service credit, and was this used? Was this used to add to the pension in the past?
That was the intent, right?
Okay, and we don't know if that's addressed in the bill or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure. This is something that you should talk to your financial advisor about.
Okay, and Amanda, it's not something you've heard debated in particular, have you?
Yeah, there are all sorts of interesting ways that Illinois in the past has kind of tried to make pensions more favorable in terms of particularly these buying service credits for years of service. My initial sense would be that in an effort to try and make this constitutional, there's a lot of grandfathering. And so anything that has been up until this point in time is generally left untouched. It's a more future forward-looking changes. But in terms of how all that would bear out again, that's where I think you'll have – I would maybe give them some time. I think that all of the retirement systems are still having to read through the 400 pages of legislation and figure out what all it means. But in due time, that would be the best way to figure out the effect on those anomalies.
Okay. Well, Rick, thank you very much for your call. And I'm wondering I think, Rick Winkle, you told me that if I'd asked you maybe a day or two earlier, you might not have been sure how you would have voted if you were still in the General Assembly on this bill. But do you have an idea now where you would fall on this question?
I would have voted no.
You would have voted no.
Yeah, I would have voted no because, you know, if this were the only solution to the structural deficit that was out there, and it really did solve that that fiscal problem. And, you know, as I say, it was the only alternative. And I was the 60th vote in the House, or I was the 30th vote in the Senate. I'd have to think long and hard on that. But I come down no, because the fact of the matter is the universities came together and did propose a more nuanced approach to this. It was out there. They're not just naysayers on December 4th trying to stop a bill. They were out there very proactively with a six-point plan that you can go to the IGPA website, igpa.uillinois.edu, and see what that six-point plan was. And that was before the legislators. That was discussed. It didn't make it into the final draft here, into the conference committee report, but they did very proactively offer an alternative to this that would have addressed some of the concerns that we've talked about today, in particular for higher education. So, you know, when I see in East Central Illinois that none of the legislators, except for Senator Brady, who was on the committee putting this together, voting for it, I do understand it, because we have a lot of state employees, we have a lot of state retirees, we have higher education to think of, and this is going to have very serious ramifications for the University of Illinois. I would have voted my district, I would have voted no.
Amanda, the recommendations that the state universities made for pension reform, how did they play out in the politics of this whole thing?
Well, I mean, they got a lot of attention. You had some of the drafters of that that proposal. You know, Jeffrey Brown, I know, was mentioned, for example, speaking to the conference committee. So I think they were taken into consideration and did play a role in this. That said, again, this is so much larger than universities. In the grand scheme of things, there are far fewer people working for public institutions of higher education in Illinois than there are state employees or teachers, who, of course, are in every district. So what you see in major pieces of legislation like that, the drafters of this legislation aren't voting their districts in that sense, or their districts aren't that. They're from Chicago. And so they have a different view of the whole situation. And, you know, could they have, for example, done a different pension system for state universities' retirements versus for state employees' retirement systems? Sure, that could have been done. I think that the likelihood of that happening wasn't all that great ever, because they were going to take one big vote on this. And they weren't going to piece all of that out. It's a hard vote for a lot of people. You've got to cobble together from all these different factions, people who have different interests, and kind of reach that compromise. And that's just what it is. I do think that it gets to this notion in terms of, you know, people who voted no, said in part that they did so because they didn't have – it didn't have the full transparency, whether you look at is it actually going to save the $160 billion that were projected? Does it hit and touch all of the fine points, or are there mistakes? Could there have been things that would have made it better? For example, you have Lieutenant Governor Sheila Simon saying that the retirement age, she thought, be more careful with that. And maybe you want to have exemptions for, say, prison guards or people that are in the line of public duty that you don't want working as old. That sort of just stuff just wasn't in there. That said, the people who did vote against it for those reasons, saying, hey, I didn't have enough time to review it, and this was put out right before the Thanksgiving holiday. Details came over then. We had this major piece of legislation with only a couple of days to review it. Many of these ideas had been out there for a very long time, and so had been given a whole lot of attention, and people had the more than enough time to decide what they thought about them. And it was going to be all or nothing. So this was going to be the bill, and there weren't, I think, any opportunities to say, hey, let's go back and retool something.
Okay. We are talking about the pension reform bill that was passed yesterday here on Focus on WILL. My guests are Amanda Vinicky, the State House Bureau Chief at Illinois Public Radio in Springfield, Rick Winkle, former state lawmaker and now with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and now joining us on Line 3, Deanna. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, I'm a state worker, and I've worked for over 20 years for the state, and I was looking forward to just having enough retirement to get by in a couple years if I work part-time. And they've taken that away from me. They've used our retirement money in order to run the state. They give money to large corporations so that they'll stay in the state with our money that should have gone to our pension. And now they've cut our pension in order to balance their budget. That is just wrong, and I am really mad. And I think that anyone who would accept a job from the state has got to be really stupid now, because you can't trust them.
Rick Winkle, do you think that a bill like this hurts the reputation of the state of Illinois as an employer?
It's going to be
I should say that we're all here employees of the state of Illinois.
Right. That's certainly, I mean, getting back to the University of Illinois higher education as an example, I mean, that's the big concern, is that we're, you know, going to be very difficult to retain and attract employees. I would also, it's going to have very, I would say for the caller, it varies impact on the size of your pension. If your salary is $45,000 or less, it's going to have minimal or no impact on you. If you're between 45 and 110, yes, it will in a ratcheting up manner. And if you're above 110, it's going to have a major, major impact. So, you know, it varies. So I think before any of us get very upset and angry, let's look at our own situation, talk to our retirement system, get some financial advice, see how it actually does impact us. But yes, it's in that sense, it's going to be very difficult for us to attract and retain as an employer state employees. I mean, there's no question about that. It's a very serious problem that faces the state universities. But I got to also say, on the flip side of this, not to be the apologist here for, you know, passage of the bill, we're also faced with a monumental fiscal problem here. We have a huge debt of at least $100 billion, and some would argue it's actually much higher than that. But we have to address these problems now in some way. And the caller is right. It's not her fault. It's the state's responsibility. And over all these years, we have not done the things that we needed to do. We've not had the discipline to pay into the system. That's why we're in the mess we are. The fact is, it's a fact that we have to change and reform that system. How we do it is the rub, of course, but we have to change it so that we can guarantee that everybody will actually receive a pension in the future. We don't want these pension systems crashing, because right now they're not sustainable.
Let me go ahead to another caller. This is Line 1. Bob, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm aware, I think, Arizona, North Carolina, the legislature's attempt to invade the pension program by other legislation or corrections or whatever. And in both cases, it was overruled by their state courts. Now, I understand that state decisions are not precedential, but in the case of Illinois, my question is, what are the chances of overturning this? Number two, is it just based upon the Police Powers Act in Illinois?
Well, I'm looking at Article 13, Section 5 of the Illinois Constitution, Pension and Retirement Rights. It's three lines here. Membership in any pension or retirement system of the state, any unit of local government or school district, or any agency or instrumentality thereof, shall be an enforceable contractual relationship, the benefits of which shall not be diminished or impaired. Those are the magic words, Rick, I understand.
Oh, no, that's very clear, and we're very unique in that sense. We have a very, very clear protection in our Constitution, the state Constitution, that protects these benefits. What we don't have in Illinois is a counter protection within the Constitution that requires or mandates that we actually have to pay in to the pensions. And what's happened is we've not done that. And so on the one hand, we've got protected payouts, but we don't have any required pay-ins. And that's why we've gotten in the soup. There's an intention read into this bill in the preamble. And it makes it very clear what the intention is. And what the caller's talking about with police powers is kind of on target here. And Senator Cullerton's been talking about quid pro quo, which gets to contract law, and there's a contractual obligation according to the Constitution, and that's what he's getting at. When it gets to the Illinois Supreme Court, they're going to be looking at the intention of the legislature to see whether there was actually a quid pro quo or a trade-off or consideration, whether the reduction of the employee contribution is sufficient consideration for this change in benefits remains to be seen. But the police power part of it is invoked because the state of Illinois is in such a fiscal mess. We have a terrible structural deficit. We have a huge debt problem. We have the worst bond rating in the country. It's almost, well, it's not almost, it's what the argument's going to be to the Illinois Supreme Court is we have an exigent or emergency situation that requires the Illinois Supreme Court to look at that otherwise clear language a little differently and maybe just read past it a little bit and not interpret it as it literally should be, but in a way that's nuanced, that addresses and takes into account the emergency situation here, and maybe will allow that is sufficient consideration. I mean, that all remains to be seen. That's all my speculation and conjecture, but it remains to be seen what the Illinois Supreme Court will do. And I have to also mention that it's interesting to note that there are five state employee pension programs involved, and I don't believe that this involves the state judges at all.
No, they were deliberately removed. I was listening to, I believe, Speaker Madigan talk on the radio about that earlier because he essentially doesn't want them to have to rule on their own salaries. What happens afterwards to that pension plan, if this thing clears up, might be another question. But Amanda Vinicky, I wanted to ask you, people who voted on this yesterday must have been knowing that a court fight was just about guaranteed with passage. How does this affect politics in an election year 2014?
Oh, boy, is this a political beast. Gosh. We'll see. Unions, of course, again, have been traditional allies of Democrats. We might see a fall off there. There's kind of an interesting divide. I say unions, but we're really primarily talking about the unions that represent, for example, teachers, AFSCME, the state's largest public employees union. They're going to, I think, have a heyday. Look for them to reward legislators that voted with them and punish those who didn't. But it's not all labor unions. You know, you have some of more the trade unions that I think were more quietly in support because anything that shores up the state budget could free up money for them, for example, for, projects and infrastructure. So there's an interesting divide there. Whereas you did see, again, unions very, very powerful, there's also very powerful big business. So they very much have wanted, you look at groups, everything from the Chamber of Commerce, Manufacturers Association, kind of any of those entities very much backed this and look for them again to contribute and reward and campaign donations ahead of the 2014 election. Individuals who voted for this because they say it will, you know, again, help to shore up the budget and provide the needed security that businesses need in order to come to Illinois or remain here, grow here. The really interesting dynamic here, as I mentioned earlier, is Bruce Rauner. So he has already put, the last check, well over $1 million of his own money into his own campaign. And it's not just him. He has a lot of other very wealthy individuals who are clearly backing him. And these are people that have grown in involvement in Illinois government over past years. And so it may be that they likewise will be giving some of those millions, I mean, really big donations to people that stuck with them. Rauner, again, opposing this. And so that's really the dynamic that I think you have here. We saw him change the discussion. Rauner picking off a lot of votes from Republicans in both the House and Senate. It may well be that that conversation is also what led to Treasurer Dan Rutherford, who had previously supported, or at least via statements, other pension proposals, not go along with this one because he said this one he thought was unconstitutional. Senator Kirk Dillard voted against it. Again, he'd previously voted for plans that were similar to this, looking at that, you know, as we talked about right at the onset of the program, that Senate Bill 1 version of Madigan. He's not doing that. That may be a Dillard attempt to win over some dollars from unions, saying, hey, I didn't go here to try and be able to combat Rauner's own primarily self-funded campaign.
Well, you know, we're out of time. And I'm very sorry that we can't take this further because I think there's a lot more to discuss here, but I think there will be plenty of more opportunities to discuss pension reform in the months ahead as this goes, as the political debate continues and the legal challenge as well. My thanks to Rick Winkle of the U of I Institute of Government and Public Affairs and Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky for being on Focus today. And if you thought pension reform was fun, come back tomorrow. We will talk about the Farm Bill. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.